Hi, I'm Glasses, and you're listening to a Radio Geekly on KBOO Portland.
Hey folks, happy 2019. This is Just Jess, and you are listening to a Radio Geekly. We've got a lot of cool stuff happening this month. We are talking video games, computer games, online gaming, and everything that goes with that. We have a few things to share with you, so let's get started. If I were to ask the question, name a video game, I'm sure a lot of you could name several popular games. A lot of Atari names, things in the Nintendo world, and of course Sony with its PlayStation and all its iterations from there. But if I were to play music from a game, would you be able to recognize it? A local musician, Glasses, sat down with me earlier this week to talk about some music that he got inspired from a game. And you all might know which game this is from. Hey folks, this is Just Jess. You are listening to a Radio Geekly, and I am joined in the studio by Gil Asayas, otherwise known as Glasses. Hey Gil, how's it going?
Hey Jess, how are you?
I am doing all right. Thanks for coming down to the studio to chat with me today.
Thanks for having me. It's a
pleasure. Yeah. So for folks that don't know much about your music, you are a local artist here in town.
Yeah.
And how long have you been playing?
Well, I started playing piano at a very young age. Probably like 8, but I've been in Portland now for 3 years and just gigging as much as possible here.
Yes, and so you've been doing some local stuff, but also been traveling nationwide.
Yeah, well, actually, earlier this year, just like out of the blue, I got this really cool gig. I was asked to be the keyboard player for this famous legendary band from the 70s called Utopia, led by Todd Rundgren. That was amazing. It was a 2-month tour all around the U.S., a little Canada as well. An amazing experience that I never even expected would happen.
That's awesome. And you were also on TV with them, right?
That's right. We were on Jimmy Kimmel. And actually, next year, I'm going on another tour with without Todd, but like the same group without Todd.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. And recently, so with that tour, you've come back and they're going to be working on some new stuff. And one of the most recent things that you've posted has been a cover of Dark World.
Yes.
And for those of you listeners, you might recognize what Dark World is. But Gil, why don't you give a little intro on what this song is?
Yeah, so Dark World is a cover from a video game. Called The Legend of Zelda. Specifically, there are a lot of Zelda games, so that's when specifically, I think the first time it appeared was in A Link to the Past for Super Nintendo in, I don't know, 90 or 89? I don't know when it came out. I don't remember. And it's one of my favorite themes from that video game. I don't know, it has this really cool melody and really amazing chords. I love the chord progression. It's kind of dark and weird. And the composer, Koji Kondo, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but he's one of my favorites. Loved it. So I actually did another Dark World cover in another Zelda video, which was like a live arrangement. And then this pedal company that makes guitar pedals reached out to me. They told me they're releasing a pedal called Dark World. And for the trailer, they want a cover of Zelda's Dark World. So they asked me if I could make the music for the trailer. I said, of course, you know, this is like best gig for me.
Yeah.
So then I made like a short 1-minute version of that cover, which was the music for the trailer, and people loved it. People went crazy for it. Also, the whole theme of the trailer was it looked like it was in a Zelda game, and like the hero finds this pedal in a chest and stuff, and people loved it. And there was a lot of demand for me to make like an extended version of it. So that's why I released the full version.
Very cool. Well, let's take a listen to a brief segment from it, and then we'll come back.
Thank you.
Such a cool song.
Thank you.
So we're here talking about video games and things, and Zelda is, I feel, one of those console games that's pretty much up there when you mention like Mario Brothers,
yeah,
you know, Donkey Kong, you know, some of those other Nintendo names.
Mm-hmm.
Was Zelda one of your first games that you got into gaming, or like how did your gaming story start?
Yeah, so my parents bought me and my brother a Game Boy, like the first handheld Game Boy back when I was like 6 years old. One of the first cartridges we got was a Zelda Link's Awakening. That was the name.
Cool.
And I remember just, yeah, like there were a lot of games I liked, but that one specifically just really drew me in. I got so absorbed in it. Just the fact that on such a like primitive console like the Game Boy, they could make this big like open world game, non-linear, with non-linear gameplay where you can just like go explore and has all these secrets and stuff. It just like blew me away completely. And I spent so many hours playing that game and finding every last secret and every piece of heart or whatever.
Yeah.
And then later on, I started playing the other installments in the, you know, Zelda series. I never actually had like a Super Nintendo, but when I was a little older and we had a computer, I got this emulator that let me play all these Super Nintendo games.
Nice.
So then I just had to like, you know, check out all these other games that I missed. So one of them was A Link to the Past, which is also like one of my favorite Zelda games. And then later on, I played Ocarina of Time and all the 3D Zeldas as well.
Yeah.
Haven't done the latest one yet, which is on the Switch,
mm-hmm.
which I'm kind of waiting, you know, to go on a little vacation and do that.
Yeah, yeah, it's a time commitment.
Yeah, yeah. Have you played that one?
I have not yet. Okay. No, I'm although I've only progressed into the Wii. I haven't gone to the Switch yet, because I feel like if I adapted to like a mobile device, then I would not be like able to connect with anything else.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's my fear that I know that if I buy that, I'll just stop making music.
And we want you to continue to make music and do all these cool things. So yeah. And with Zelda, what was the impetus to create music based upon this game, or like what influenced you to go, you know what, I want to make a cover of this song?
So the thing is, when you're playing these games, you end up hearing the same tunes over and over so many times, they just become ingrained in you. And there were a lot of soundtracks that I liked for these games, like the Mario soundtrack is great and some other games as well. But specifically, the Zelda soundtrack has this sort of like a weird kind of dark undertone to it that I really loved. Really interesting chord progressions and just the use of the very basic technology was amazing for the time. So those tunes have always been a part of me. And I would always like sit at the piano and play some of them for fun. You know, I never forgot them. And I always knew that I wanted to eventually do a cool cover of those. So that's the reason I did it.
And how did you find out? Did you do research in terms of like who was composing all of this stuff? Like, obviously, when you're a kid, I mean, for me, I would be like, oh, that's a cool song. But not wanting to like research like who composed it.
Yeah.
You know, like what drew you to want to like find out like who composed it and what their music was about?
I was always kind of interested, you know, growing up as a musician, kind of interested in knowing who created this music. So even the Game Boy had the credits on it and you could see the composer and stuff. So Koji Kondo is a name that always came up. He didn't write the music for all the Zelda games, but for most of them, and at least the biggest ones. And I just love his style. He did also the Mario stuff and
wow,
a lot of other Nintendo games as well.
Very cool. And you also have another video where you do multiple themes from Zelda. Were those all Koji Kondo compositions as well?
Most of them.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. There were a few from later Zelda games, which had some other composers as well.
Yeah.
Most of them were written by Koji Kondo. And that was my first Zelda video, actually. And it was because of that one that the pedal company reached out to me, because they saw that and they liked it.
Yeah. And for folks to check it out on YouTube, you can go to youtube.com and search for Glasses, G-L-A-S-Y-S. And I'm sure it'll pop up your channel or something, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks. And if you look for it, it's really cool because you have that opening scene of like you're going to the treasure box and you're like opening it up and you're like thinking, oh, it's Link finding a treasure, but it's like, no, it's Gil finding this petal. And I just thought that was so great. It was like,
thank you.
Yeah, it was just kind of this cool mashup of, you know, being a musician but then also a gamer at the same time. And
it was an opportunity to like completely geek out and have fun with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what instrumentation do you have when you recorded those two videos? I know you've got a lot of stuff besides just like your keyboard and your synth and stuff.
Yeah. So the first video is a live video. I mean, it's not live in front of an audience. It's live in studio. And what I do is I create these really challenging arrangements where I try to play all the parts simultaneously. I don't know why I do it. I guess like to make life difficult for myself. But I've got this like custom-made controller built by this really talented dude called Moldover. And what I can do with that controller is I can play the drum part on these arcade buttons. So I can like finger drum. And then with my thumb and with my pinky, I can play on a little keyboard the bass part. So I can do like with one hand, I can play both the drum and bass part. And then with my right hand, I play the melodies and chords and whatnot. Yeah. So for this, the first Zelda video I made, I took 7 of my favorite themes and I arranged them for this controller. And it's fun. You know, it's challenging and it takes a lot of practice. But once you can pull it off, it's like really rewarding because it's like you're creating this big sound just live by yourself. So it's cool.
Yeah.
And then for the second one, I took a different approach. That was more of like a produced track, you know, I recorded one part at a time, polished it, made a complete song out of it. So different approaches for both.
Yeah. And on the Dark World video, you've got a pretty rad outfit, too.
Oh, thanks.
Was that also inspired by, you know, something in gaming, or were you just like, I just want to wear this cool robe?
So the first video was done on my own. I shot it with my camera and stuff. So for the second one, I wanted to work with a pro videographer, and I worked with a friend of mine who was already done a few videos with me. His name is John Thompson, a local guy in Portland, super talented. And you know, before we shot the video, I told him like I wanted to have a kind of dark mood because of the theme and stuff, and have some like props and stuff that make it feel a little more like in the world of Zelda. I basically, my only idea was to have like a little chest where I find the pedal, but his ideas were to have that cool keyboard stand, which was like those two columns that looked like Roman columns or whatever. Those were his, and the robe was his as well. I didn't even know I'd be wearing it until I got there. He was like, hey, try this on. And I thought, no, that's going to be ridiculous. No, he said, it's going to be cool. Trust me. And so, yeah.
It looks cool. Yeah. Oh, it totally worked out. So kudos to John for that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
So getting back into like your gaming history and stuff, Gil, what would you say would be like the point in which you found yourself becoming a musician but being influenced in the gaming world? Was there like a moment in your life where you're like, you know what, I want to like become a keyboard player, I want to create music because of, you know, the cool stuff that like Koji Kondo was doing? Or is there like an impetus of, yes, this is my decision moving forward? Or was it kind of a longer term thing for you to figure out?
Yeah, it was, I think, more of a long term thing. I mean, the reason I got into synths in the first place is not because of games. It's more because of like alternative bands that I love, like Radiohead and their use of synths. But then after that, I kind of circled back and realized just how much I loved those 8-bit soundtracks that I grew up listening to, and realized that I could create all that with synths, and started using those kind of sounds as well. So yeah, I think growing up and hearing on the one hand acoustic instruments, because both my parents were classical musicians, and, you know, I played piano and stuff, and these really basic 8-bit tones from the Game Boy kind of made me want to just fuse both of them into something. And that's what I'm trying to experiment with now.
Nice. Do you have a favorite character in the gaming world? It could be from Zelda. It can be from Mario. It could be from anything.
Favorite character? I really like the Metroid character, Samus.
Okay.
Yeah. That's also like one of my favorite franchises for sure. But yeah, Link, I guess. Not that he has a character, because he never says anything.
Right.
I guess you're the character. So.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. Like, you are, I mean, he is named as Link, but Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, he never said the thing. I never
thought about that until now. That is true. I was like, he doesn't have really much, any dialogue, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's all, everything around it that gives him the character, I guess.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And do you have a favorite console that you like playing on?
Oh, man. Right now, I don't even own a console. I really want to get the Switch and check it out, because that Breath of the Wild Zelda game looks incredible. But yeah, I enjoyed playing the 3DS for a while. I did that and then sold it when I realized that I'm playing it way too much. Yeah, I think of a Game Boy. The first Game Boy will always hold a special place in my heart, you know?
Yeah. Do you ever wish that you had one of those, the Game Boys just like back and you can, like you were saying, you were able to play some of the like SNES games on a computer. Do you wish you would have one of those consoles now where you can actually hook up to Game Boy games? Because I think they have them, right? Or you can
play any, that's like, you can play anything on an emulator now on your computer.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't have it with me, but my brother in Israel still has the original Game Boys and they still work.
Whoa.
Which is incredible. They were built like tanks back then.
Wow. So that's the original like black and white, right?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not in color.
Yeah.
Wow.
We never had like a fancier console. That's the one we grew up with. But it's amazing what, you know, the video game companies could accomplish with so little.
Yeah.
I mean, even the music engines, they had like four tracks to work with. And the drums would just be like these little bursts of white noise, like, psst, 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 you know?
Yeah.
But it would still somehow, they'd make it sound like a complete piece of music. It's incredible.
That is really cool. Well, once again, folks can check out your music and the videos that you did with Zelda and the covers for Dark World. And what were the 7 themes from that first video that you did?
Yeah, the first one was, I started with like the chest opening theme, which also has like a cool little melody to it. And then I did the fairy fountain, which I think is in every Zelda game. I did a cover of Dark World, then I think it was Zelda's Lullaby, Lost Woods, Shake's theme from Ocarina of Time, Midna's Lament. I think that's it. Was that 7?
Yes, that was 7.
Okay.
Awesome.
I managed to remember.
Yeah. Yeah. So if folks want to check out those videos, you can go to youtube.com and look for Glasys, GLASYS. And you also have a website too, right, Gil?
Yeah, glasysmusic.com.
Okay. And folks can listen to it, sign up for your newsletter. And do you have any downloads available for folks?
Yeah, all these Zelda themes are available as a free download from my website.
Awesome.
And the newer cover is on, you know, all the streaming websites as well, and iTunes and all that.
Cool. Do you have any upcoming shows or things or ideas in the works?
Yeah. So I've been working a lot on my new album, which is all originals. And that's going to be coming out probably in the late spring, early summer. And I plan on touring after that. So I'm going to be doing a lot of the stuff I do on my videos live. And I'm working on building a new set.
Very cool. Yeah. And you had that tour coming up that you were going to
Yeah, that's a short tour. It's only 2 weeks with Kazem Sultan's Utopia. So the bass player and second lead singer of Utopia, he does his own version of Utopia. So it's going to be a little smaller than the first tour, but still really cool and I'm excited.
Awesome. Well, Gil Asayas, also known as Glasys, thanks for coming to the studio to talk to me on Radio Geekly.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah.
Always a pleasure talking about this stuff. My wife doesn't want to talk about it.
Well, props to her for helping with the videography, though, right?
Oh, yeah. For sure. Couldn't have done that chest opening thing, scene without her.
Thanks, Gil.
Thank you.
Collective member Tabitha has been loving the new PlayStation 4 game Bloodborne, and she sat down with some of her friends that are also playing with her to get an insight on the game, their thoughts, what they liked about it, what they disliked about it, and more.
Hello, my name is Tabitha, and I'm excited to finally have a chance to talk about what I think is now one of my favorite video games. It's called Bloodborne. It's a PS4 exclusive, and it came out in 2015. And I'm also joined by two friends that I made play the game. Do y'all want to introduce yourselves?
My name's Patrick. I have played the game, about once. And I definitely had fun with it. I guess I'm just going to bring like the whole newbie experience up to the table in this particular discussion.
I'm Tabby's roommate, Virginia, and she didn't make me play it. I wanted to play it. I played Dark Souls 1 and 2 before I played Bloodborne. Tabby will talk more about what those have to do with Bloodborne, I imagine.
So Bloodborne is developed by a Japanese game company called From Software. They are also the same developers as Dark Souls 1, 2, and 3, and Demon Souls. They've been developing game. They've been around for like a couple decades. I feel like recently their thing has been making kind of esoteric hard games that have a niche but very passionate fan base.
Yeah.
But I first found out about Bloodborne this year. I'd never really heard of the From Software games or Bloodborne. I really can't remember how. I sort of stumped. No, actually, I do. It was a YouTuber that I watched. But he was talking about Bloodborne. And I really liked the art style. And then I went and, God bless YouTube, and having a plethora of Let's Players. And I watched a Let's Play of Bloodborne. It's like, whoa, this looks really cool. But I don't have a PS4. So I didn't think that I'd ever really have a chance to play it. But as so happens, a few months ago, my cousin said he was selling his PS4. It's like, sweet! And Virginia and I went halvesies on it. And then I bought Bloodborne. That's been kind of my obsession for the past 2 months.
Mm-hmm. We play it together by switching off between our characters.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like not co-op kind of.
Mm-hmm. That's one reason why I asked Virginia to be here, because you've played Dark Souls 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
You're kind of...
How do they compare, by the way?
Yeah. You're kind of a veteran.
It's hard to compare them, I think. I feel like Bloodborne, the feel of the game is much more like Dark Souls 2, and that it feels more video gamey than Dark Souls 1, which is a hard thing to quantify. There's also like more NPCs you can talk to, so it feels a little less lonely than the first Dark Souls game. And it's easier than Dark Souls, but it's got the same sort of like attention to lore and detail, and a lot of the same like systems and combat sort of. So it was pretty easy for me to pick up Bloodborne after playing Dark Souls, and I still refer to my Blood Echoes as Souls because I forget.
Since we were roommates, we lived together, I have watched you play Dark Souls, and I wouldn't say I'm a veteran, but I'm familiar with the story, and I do enjoy watching you and other people playing it, but I'm not sure it's really my kind of game. Mm-hmm. Because it seems it's a little too slow for my kind of speed, and when it comes
that's
to...
That's why I like it.
And when I play games, I'm kind of a blunt instrument where I think it's because I played so many RPGs growing up, and in RPGs, I feel like there's a pretty big margin for error, or maybe that's not the right term, but...
Well, you can kind of grind your way out of situations in RPGs, right?
Yeah, yeah. if you make a mistake, it's not the end of the world. And it definitely seems like in the Souls games that, and also in Bloodborne sometimes, you make one wrong move and, oh,
it's definitely like that.
Dying sucks.
You get used to it.
I guess one thing that I do like that the developers have put in, that there's not a huge penalty for death.
Yeah.
In Bloodborne, if you die, you just lose all your Blood Echoes, which is the currency in the game. But you've told me that in the Dark Souls games, there is a kind of a big penalty for whenever you die.
In the second one, your quantity of health goes down. Okay. The more times you die, it'll stop at about halfway, but it won't restore again until you make yourself human again.
Okay.
So I feel like I played a lot of the game where I could have had like twice as much health as I did, just because every time you die, you lose that little bit, and I didn't always feel like being human.
Yeah, well, you're a human every day in real life, so.
Yeah, that's true.
So I guess that's, me and Virginia's experiences with the From Software games. And Patrick is one of the friends that I made play the game, because also in the last 2 months, I've been either insisting friends come over to play it or bringing the PS4 over to other friends to, like, you must play this game.
Yeah, I remember I was over there. You kind of twisted my arm into doing it.
Yes. So what did you think of the game?
Well, after I got over, like, the whole, like, I don't know, Tabs, I don't really know what I'm doing. And it was something that you kind of, like, adapt to. And yeah, I kind of get what you mean, where like it's a sort of blunt instrument sort of playing. Like I hesitate to say like Leroy Jenkins, but you can kind of actually make that work in Bloodborne.
Yeah.
I admit that like it's story-wise, like this is a weird tendency I have. Like just chalk this up to my own insanity, I suppose. But if I'm not really told a story in a game, I start making up my own story, which is why I can't play Animal Crossing like a normal person.
So what do you think is going on in Bloodborne?
I think the hunter is just a blood-obsessed weirdo that went to a Yharnam because she figured out that, like, as like, hey, I can, like, inject a bunch of blood and see some really weird stuff. It's going to be awesome. And then you go and, like, this blood minister's like, pale blood, you've come to the right place. And it's like, yeah, you got the good stuff or not. And, like, you know, get shot up with Yharnam blood, and then, like, you see a bunch of weird monsters come out of the floor and, like, hey, guys, will you be my friend?
Yeah, I guess you touched on one of the things that I guess I like about the game. So the number one thing I do really like about Bloodborne is the art style. Watching Virginia play the Dark Souls games, they look like they take place in a medieval high fantasy sort of world. But it's very dark.
Have elevators.
Yeah, well, you know, I would say that if anybody is into like something like Castlevania, this might be your jam.
Mm-hmm. Bloodborne takes place in this gothic Victorian setting, and I'm a bit of a goth. The art style is already right up my alley. When I learned more about the game, it feels like there are a lot of literary references. I think on the Wikipedia page, but it said that the creator of the game, Hidetaki Miyazaki, said he was very inspired by Bram Stoker's Dracula, and I think it really shows. The spoiler-free story of the game is that your character, the protagonist, you can choose whether to be a man or a woman. Unfortunately, there aren't any non-binary options, but you can headcanon your character however you want. Your character has come to this city of Yharnam to get blood ministration, and they have a really weird vision, and then they suddenly find themselves caught up in the hunt. I can really see, I guess, the Bram Stoker's Dracula influences in the game as far as, like, the blood ministration goes. And I think some of the creature designs look like they could be Frankenstein's monsters, too. And then you're also fighting werewolves, and there are also these giant crows that you are also killing. And the game is just full of these things that are straight out of a gothic Victorian novel. And I think the game also takes a lot more literary inspiration in the second half of the game, because
no spoilers.
We're not getting into spoilers, huh?
I will try to keep this as spoiler-free.
Should I cover my ears?
I'm not going to say, but in the second half of the game, it does take a lot of Lovecraft-inspired twists. And even though Lovecraft is very problematic, the second half of the game does take a very cosmic horror twist about halfway through the game.
Well, there's some Lovecraftian elements in the bits that I ended up seeing as well. I mean, if you're really, really looking for them, the way the hunt works, at least as far as I understand it, I did some kind of reading on my own, and sorry about like any sort of inaccuracies I may say about now. The people that the huntsmen throughout the town that you're killing, like as I understand it, like they were given the Yharnam blood too, and they're partially starting to go insane in their own heads, and their bodies are starting to change, and like it's very like a Innsmouth kind of thing going on, you know.
Patrick, I think you played like 2 hours of it.
Something like that. I didn't get very far. I didn't actually reach the first boss or anything like that. I was mostly just getting killed by the other huntsmen and stuff like that.
That's just kind of how it goes, too. My first time playing Dark Souls, I just spent dying for several hours.
I've addressed, like, the artistic parts of the game that I like. But I guess talking about the technical parts of the game, because not everyone is all about, like, the art style, the art direction.
Yeah, well, like, if you're into Castlevania, if you're into Berserk, this might be your jam.
The sound design is really good. That's my
I
addition.
Love the sound design.
Oh, yeah, the soundtrack.
Yeah, and, oh, the voice acting. The voice acting work was done in England. I think they picked really great voice actors to voice the NPCs and the human bosses and enemies that you fight. I guess talking about the technical aspects of the game, I do like how quick and fast combat is. The weapons, there aren't a whole lot of weapons. There's only like 20 weapons in the base game. And also maybe about 20 different sets of armor. But the thing is, all the weapons and all the armor, they all have very similar stats. And so I like that the game, it's not really so equipment focused, because I feel like in a lot of other video games, you know, if your character comes across a better sword, you're obviously going to go with a better sword or the better helmet. But in Bloodborne, since it kind of doesn't really matter what your armor or your weapon is, I mean, obviously it matters depending on what your playstyle is, but you can make it to the end game, to the end of the game with your starting weapon that you pick. So I like how very focused the armor and the weapons are, and also weapon upgrading is very easy.
I don't know, I'm kind of married to the axe that I picked. I really like the axe, and if there's gonna be a tree monster later on, I'm so ready.
As someone who gets really overwhelmed by weapon systems and like just gets kind of frustrated when you give me too many options, I really like that too.
Patrick, I'm curious, would you be interested in playing more of Bloodborne? I know you had a hard time getting out of the first area, but that.
I did get out of the first area.
Okay. Oh, that's right, you did.
You could just make me do it like Tabby does.
It's too hard.
Okay. Yeah, in fairness, if I'm over there and I'm playing, Virginia will probably be there too. So like, hey, Virginia, can you do this for me? But yes, I would want to play it again.
I'll be playing it again.
Thank you, Virginia and Patrick, for joining me in this discussion about Bloodborne. I also think everyone should go check out Virginia's Twitter, because she's linked her account to her Twitter account, but you share screenshots and short video clips of you playing the game that are really funny.
Yeah, so my Twitter handle is Milky Boots Comics. That's comics with an X. Or you can just search for Virginia Payne.
Virginia, want to go play more Bloodborne now?
Yeah.
Cool.
The world of video gaming has progressed into the online world where folks can log on to YouTube or Twitch and watch other people play these games online. So this next segment is from me. It's a previous recording back from 2016 where I went to Wizard World Comic Con and interviewed Matthew Mercer, voice actor for many video games and television shows, talking to him about his career and what he does on the online Twitch channel Critical Role.
Well, you've done a lot of voiceover work for such things as like Minecraft and Resident Evil, even some TV stuff, Naruto, Thundercats, Bleach. How did you get into voice acting? Did you wake up one morning and go, hey, I got a pretty good voice for this kind of thing?
For me, it was a transition based on, one, being a theater kid. I did a lot of theater, a lot of community theater and independent theater when I was younger, and being a huge nerd and loving cartoons and video games. So after years of kind of pursuing one passion and discovering that there was a possible career path to merge my other passion, I decided to go ahead and start prodding and pushing in that direction. And it's a long, long process, long, arduous process filled with rejection, filled with creative lifestyle of, you know, tiny apartment, subsisting on ramen. but after a long time just pushing in towards that goal and kind of fighting against the obstructions and the rejection, I probably began to get a foothold and build a career from there.
Cool. Do you find yourself that you like doing TV over video games? Do you have a preference?
I wouldn't say I have a preference. I like them both for different reasons. I like video games as a video gamer and as the fact that as an interactive experience, there isn't one straight narrative through most projects. You have branching narratives and possible, you know, outcomes based on the player's actions. And I love that you get to kind of play through and perform each facet of that story. And a lot of the genres are right up my alley. So I'm already a nerd for my own stuff. However, for, you know, Western animation in particular, a lot of those are group recordings. So it feels like a radio play. And so you get to play off of each other and, you know, record together and kind of use each other's energy and performances to really kind of deliver a ensemble performance. Whereas video games is more of a solitary recording experience for the most part. I mean, occasionally we get to do motion capture and performance capture games, and those are a little closer to theater, and those are fantastic experiences as well. I can't say I prefer one over the other. I just like them for different reasons.
Okay, cool. Then speaking of radio theater, have you ever done any radio theater or thought about the possibility of like non-visual medias, like audiobooks or things like that?
I have a lot of friends who do audiobooks. I have not done them myself yet. I haven't had the opportunity really come up, but that may change in the future. I've done a few radio plays for a couple local L.A. productions, and I did a long-running kind of live radio play performance that then will be put up online for a production called Tales of the Extraordinary.
Okay.
And so Talison Jaffe, who's part of Critical Role, also guested on that a bunch, and so yeah, we did that for a while, and that was a lot of fun.
Nice. So with doing a lot of voiceover work and stuff, and then you slowly transitioned into doing like director, producer kind of roles, mm-hmm. was that an easier transition because you were also on like the other side of the camera in a way?
I think it definitely lends itself because you understand multiple facets of production. It's one thing to go into it from a single point and stick to that, but you understand your role very well from your perspective. Going in from a performer standpoint, going in and then like branching off into doing costume and production design and art direction and doing prop work and then going into actually line producing and then regular producing and ADing and gripping, you get a feel of all different facets of production, which when you get to the point of directing a project, you have a better understanding of how everything functions together, allowing you to be a better director because you have an understanding of how everyone's supposed to kind of have a symbiotic relationship.
So I
would say it definitely helps to have other aspects of experience in the production cycle. Not necessary, but it does definitely help.
Yeah. Did you see yourself making it easy to, like with the Let There Be Raw, did you find it easy to be like, well, I'm going to play this character because I know how he's supposed to act, and then did that trigger the other actors to kind of play off your performances?
Hilariously, I have a hard time casting myself in my own production. It sounds dumb, and most of the actors I know are like, that's the point of doing this, is to put yourself out there, but... Yeah. I tend to lend myself to the character more than I do myself, and so if I feel there's somebody out there who's better for a particular role, I'll cast them over me easily, because I want it to be what's best for that performance. And I've directed a number of projects online with characters in mind that I might be able to try, but let me audition people for it. I'm like, oh no, this goes to them. Ganondorf in There'll Be Brawl was particularly a scenario where we couldn't find anybody that could get what I wanted out of it, and everyone else in the production just kept saying, why don't you do it? Why don't you? I'm like, we'll see. And after we went through a few processes, I just finally gave in and was like, fine, I'll do it.
Yeah. Cool. Very cool. Well, now let's do some more of the current stuff. You're here, obviously, with the Critical Role Collective.
Yes.
Have you ever been a game master before, or is this kind of your first time?
Oh, I've been game mastering for close to 20 years.
Okay.
This since high school. This has been... it's been my proverbial jam.
Okay.
I love tabletop role-playing games, and it's a big part of really what I got into theater, you know, for started with these type of games.
Yeah.
The flair for improv and storytelling. So yeah, it's definitely a big part of my life.
Was it different to have cameras in your face and actually record it for YouTube?
Yeah, but not as much as we thought it would be. We were worried it would change the experience a lot. And,
right.
And it was a big kind of a bit of hesitance on even agreeing to do this, because this game that we ran for 2 years privately before it went to the stream. So it was a continuation of a pre-existing story that we had kind of kept as a personal experience. So that was a big concern of ours. But thankfully, it didn't really impede the experience, the feeling we had from previous games when we were just in our living room.
Very cool.
So I was happy about that.
And have you seen platforms like YouTube kind of increase the exposure of things like Critical Role for you guys?
Tremendously. I mean, there's so many great forms of social media distribution right now through YouTube, through Twitch, and other emerging platforms that are still in their infancy, where it isn't about just creating content and delivering it to an audience. Now we're getting to a point where we can deliver content and interact with the audience, and the audience having some level of participation in how the media's outcome is. And that level of interactivity is not only fantastic from a consumption standpoint, but it builds a community that is so much more invested in the actual property itself. And so with us, like, our show is just a show. It would be nothing without the community that sprung up around it, and I think they're more important than we are, based on just the level of involvement they've shown in helping the world at large, the level of outpouring of support for various charities that have come out of this community around us has been so much more than anything we've done.
Cool.
You know, we're just happy to have been a catalyst to it.
Yeah, and as we could see, for our radio audience, there actually is a line here for the Critical Role Collective to get some autographs and stuff, so there is a fan base, and I think a lot of it comes from those social media platforms.
It's been great.
Yeah, I know for us as a community radio, we strive on the community involvement.
It's so everything, it really is. It's where a lot of media is going, I think, going forward.
Yeah.
And which is good, one, because it not only is it more of an investment from an audience standpoint, but two, community is a thing that's, I feel, from a social standpoint, has been eroded over the years based on just the way that, not to get too, you know, esoteric or political and stuff here, but I feel that as a culture, both as, you know, as a people and as a country, the sense of community has been eroded by kind of fear-mongering in media in a lot of ways, you know, instilling xenophobic tendencies from people that are outside of your comfort zone. And with the coming of the internet, while it brought a lot of communities together, it also began to kind of alienate and isolate the interpersonal contact that became just a series of texts and numbers. I think we're coming full circle now, where social media is beginning to move past that and connect people on a more personal level through the internet and kind of become a global culture. And it's pretty fantastic to see it on the cusp of actually going that direction.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. And last question, if you could create any cross-genre story, what would it be?
Oh, man. I have a fascination with esoteric deities, like ancient Mesopotamian deities, like, you know, Marduk, Tiamat, Enki, the god of magic, Aspu, the god of the abyss. Like, I love ancient Sumerian and Mesopotamian religion. I would love to see those type of entities brought back into a modern day setting, almost like an American Gods type way. And they did a little bit of that there. But I like the idea of, you know, kind of the Lovecraftian elements of taking these ancient powers that are beyond mortal understanding and bringing it back in, but tying it more to the existing Sumerian pantheon would be really, really cool.
Would you want to do like a promo for it? You can like spit, like, you're like, someone was trying to pitch you, like, hey Matt, can you give us a new story? How would you pitch it?
I'd probably do it in a trailer fashion.
Okay.
Be like, the world consumed by politics, petty squabbles, humanity at its own throat. What they didn't know was the ancient gods that they so long ago kicked to the side have returned to take their attention and lives. It's a terrible, terrible trailer, but, you know.
Off the cuff, man.
Just the idea across.
And the bagpipes are closing us off, apparently. He's a local legend.
It's not often you get played off an interview, but if you're going to do it, this is the way to do it.
This is the way to do it. Matthew Mercer, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you for having me.
Find out more information about Critical Role on the Geek & Sundry page on YouTube.
GeekandSundry.com, or we actually play live on Twitch pretty much every Thursday at 7 p.m. Pacific time.
Okay.
So go to Geek & Sundry. a Twitch page for that.
Great, and more information just about your roles and things, MatthewMercer.com.
You can just go to MatthewMercerOnline.com, although I'm still updating that website, so just Google Matthew Mercer, you'll find all kinds of craziness.
Great, awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You know, gaming in its many forms can be fun, but there are often issues when it comes to the gaming industry, unfortunately. And this segment is from an earlier recording where collective member Rob sat down with Anita Sarkeesian, founder of Feminist Frequency, a nonprofit organization that takes a look at media through a critical feminist lens. She was describing about gatekeeping and women affected by that in the gaming industry and in media in general. So let's take a listen to that now.
So I run Feminist Frequency, which is an educational nonprofit. We look at the way women are represented within popular culture. So our biggest, our most well-known project to date is called Tropes Versus Women in Video Games, where we're specifically looking at some of the really harmful, kind of degrading representations of women throughout the history of gaming. We also are in the process of releasing our latest series called Ordinary Women Daring to Defy History, and that is telling the stories of women who've been written out of history, because too often the history books are full of stories about men, and women are completely erased from all of the incredible, amazing things that we've done, and actually, like, some of the work that women have done has been so instrumental to changing the way that we exist today. You know, if it wasn't for women, computers wouldn't look like they do currently, for example. And so I think it's really important that we share and tell those stories.
I have to ask, were you referencing Lovelace?
Yeah. So one of the women we're talking about is Ada Lovelace, who was the first computer programmer, who sadly, when she was alive, men were constantly undermining her at that time as well. She had a doctor who said that she was sick because she was using her woman brain for man things. And so, you know.
I hear that can cause the vapors.
Yeah, God. And so, you know, shortly thereafter, she died of cancer. So, one, tragic, but also high science, right?
Yeah.
And even today, her legacy is disputed. So it was really important to us in our video to unequivocally say she is the first computer programmer. She was, she imagined things at that time that were just almost impossible to imagine. It was incredible. So she foresaw the digital age of what we exist in now. Not exactly how it is now, obviously, but to be able to have that foresight and that imagination is just incredible.
I should say so. For our listeners, where can they go to watch this series?
Yeah, so our website, feministfrequency.com, has all of our videos. It has a whole video archive. It also, we just revamped it, so it's got a bunch of new stuff on it as well. We have a resource section that has tons of different things on it. So if you want suggestions of games, movies, TV shows, comics, books that we recommend that we think have either feminist or social justice kinds of lenses or interesting things in them, we have little, we have pages full of that. We also have resources.
Binders
full of resources. It's great. We also have guides to, you know, like if you want to make your workplace more, like hire more women and make it more friendly to women, we have some resources and suggestions of places to find information about that. So there's just a ton of stuff that we added to the site. So feministfrequency.com.
Very cool. I'll be definitely checking that out.
Yeah.
So Geek Girl Con, as you said, is this amazing, safe, welcoming, inclusive environment. It's not like other conventions I've been to, for sure. And it's a relatively new innovation as of like 6 years ago. So in context of, I mean, you've been through a lot with Gamergate, which is what I hate to bring up, and I don't want to give too much airtime to this, like, you know, basically the put beep in here that you've had to deal with. But maybe you could speak to like how Gamergate impacted you professionally, personally, and tell us, I mean, clearly the culture is moving in a positive direction, or at least that's what we're seeing here. So maybe you can talk about how what the culture is developing through Gamergate and going, I mean, from what we see here in a positive direction, but I mean, you would be more authority on that than I.
Sure. So What we now call Gamergate was an incident that occurred, an incident, that's funny to say that, that occurred in the summer of 2014. Zoe Quinn, who is a game developer, her ex-boyfriend wrote a screed online that was full of lies.
What is a screed?
I don't even know that. I feel like a screed. He wrote a blog post that was just like a really hateful, angry blog post. And put it out into all of the areas in which the communities harass women, 4chan, Reddit, that sort of thing. And so the content of this blog post was full of lies, just saying that she had slept with reporters to get coverage for her game, which never happened. And then there was this, you know, like tons of stuff that came into it. It really legitimately was domestic violence. And what happened from there is it sort of exploded. The harassment exploded onto women in the gaming industry because there was this myth around the fact that that the harassment, which they, obviously the harassers didn't call it harassment, were defending ethics in games journalism. That was the sort of their tagline, which was not it at all, because you don't send death threats and rape threats and misogynist and racist and transphobic slurs to women online through all of their channels and just basically try to destroy their lives and silence them if you're trying to have a conversation about ethics and games journalism, right? Which is a conversation to have, but that's not what they were doing at all. If we rewind a couple of years, I launched a Kickstarter in 2012 to fund the series that I spoke about previously, looking at women in video games, and that's when the harassment for me really started. So my entire social media, all my emails, every way that you could possibly get a hold of me, my Kickstarter account, was all flooded with harassment. They would send pizzas to addresses they thought were mine with extra sausage because they think that that's funny. There were campaigns to take down all of my social media accounts, take down my videos on YouTube, which sometimes they were successful at doing. Knock my website offline for days at a time. They organized campaigns to contact the IRS and the FBI to say that I'm a fraud and a con artist because I was raising money to pay for a video series, this has been going on for years. Like, it started then and it still continues. Wow. Right? It hasn't stopped. So when Gamergate came around, it was just like an extension, like the next saga for me of the harassment. And I'm not the only woman by any means that's been harassed. That same year in 2012, Jennifer Hepler was harassed at BioWare, and Felicia Day was harassed for making a country music video about video games because how dare she do something fun and interesting and cute.
Right.
Aisha Tyler was harassed for hosting the E3 Ubisoft show. And so, you know, and this just went on and on and on, right? And eventually what happened is I think the media actually started covering these stories. They actually started talking about these issues, about the way that women are, and these are just the big names, right? Like, there are so many women who are being harassed that don't get the spotlight and don't get known and don't get the support that they need. And that was one of the things that happened with Gamergate too, is that just so many more women got sucked into these harassment campaigns that just weren't as visible and weren't getting the support that they needed. So, you know, folks like me and Zoe got a lot of media time, a lot of airtime. And, you know, we were trying to say, like, it's not just us. There's so many people being harassed right now, and it's really intense. Excuse me. So the thing about the harassment is that it hasn't stopped. You know, we often talk about Gamergate in the past tense, and we often talk about, like, harassment online in the past tense, especially in gaming, because that was sort of like a peak in some ways. But we just don't, those of us who are targeted don't talk about it every day because, like, it's exhausting. It's right. Exhausting for our followers and our viewers. It's exhausting for us because we need to live our lives and do our work. And actually, you know, one of the things is being recognized for the work that we do and not for being victims of harassment.
Right.
So, you know, the harassment still happens, and you ask any of us who are being harassed that it's not, it's still a daily occurrence.
I mean, is there a rhyme or reason to the harassment?
Sure.
I'm not trying to condone or justify it.
So we're talking about, a group of men, mostly men, who are who have an enormous sense of entitlement. And, you know, if you want to get really feminist theory on this, you know, patriarchy tells men that they, this is where entitlement comes, like any communities of privilege have entitlement. That's what privilege is, right. one of the bases of privilege. So you have men who are told their entire lives from growing up that they deserve hot women, they deserve fast cars, they deserve, like, good job, you know, I'm being a little silly about it, but, like, this is legitimate, right? They deserve good-paying jobs, they deserve women, they deserve a lot of money, they deserve, like, all of the things that society deems as success. And when they don't get that, because most people don't, they get real mad.
Right.
And so folks who live in the intersections of oppression are used to not getting these things, right? Like, we don't tend to lash out aggressively when we don't get our way, because you're used to living constantly undermined, right? And that's one of the horrible, sad things about oppression and privilege. So I think that a lot of men who felt this sense of aggrieved entitlement, of feeling like they deserve all these things and not getting them, get really angry at women. And that is the outlet that they put their aggression on. And so video games are something that this group has deemed is a male pastime that looks a particular way, that games can only exist in this sort of macho domain. And when there's any question about that, when there's anyone that comes in and says, hey, women game too, and we always have, and we've always been in these communities, and we've always been playing and making games, they get really pissed. And so some of it, I think, is that sort of, like, deep anger of lashing out against women that they see as encroaching on their territory, on their male domain. No, yeah.
Wow.
Which is... Actually, I should just... I don't know if I can say that.
Oh, no, it's okay. We'll leave that out. You just gave me an amazing, like, discourse.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. This was great.
So this is a Radio Geekly, and we've been here with Anita Sarkeesian. Anita, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We have so much more to talk about with video games, computer games, and more. So we are going to extend this conversation into our February episode as well. If you have content you would like to contribute, please shoot us an email at aradiogeekly@kboo.fm. Or you can check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/Radio Geekly, or on Twitter @Radio Geekly. This is Just Jess signing off. Thanks so much for listening, and we will catch you all next month.